I know you done my brother in, and I'm going to kill you. Though he didn't carry through, he obviously felt Manson was responsible. When Danny DiCarlo had his marathon session with LAPD, he was asked, "What do you know about a 16-year-old boy that was shot?" DiCarlo replied, "That had nothing to do with anybody up there. I'll tell you why, because they were just as shocked about it as I was. If they had done it, they would have told me." DiCarlo informed the officers about the brothers' call. One asked, "Why do you think he suspected Charlie?" DiCarlo replied, "Because there aren't too many maniacs on the street that would just pull a gun on someone and blow their head off for no reason at all." LAPD didn't pursue it further, since this was LASO's case. The murder remains unsolved. In a period of 1 month, between July 27th and August 26th, 1969, Charles Manson and his murderous family slaughtered 9 people. Gary Hinman, Stephen Parent, Jay Sebring, Abigail Folger, Wojtek Frykowski, Sharon Tate, Lino LaBianca, Rosemary LaBianca, and Donald Che. Though it is known that a number of female family members were involved in the cleanup operation that followed Shay's murder, none has ever been tried as an accessory after the fact. Some are still on the streets today. Manson's arrest on October 12, 1969, did not stop the murders. As already mentioned, on November 5, 1969, John Philip Haught, a.k.a. Christopher Jesus, a.k.a. Zero, was shot to death in a beach house in Venice. The 4 family members still present when the police arrived claimed he had killed himself while playing Russian roulette. Linda Baldwin, a.k.a. Little Patty, true name Madeline Joan Cottage, said she had been lying on the bed next to him when it happened. The others, Bruce Davis, Susan Bartell, a.k.a. Country Sue, and Kathy Gillies, all told the officers they hadn't witnessed the act, but had heard the shot. At least one, and possibly all, lied. During the penalty phase of the Tate-LaBianca trial, I asked Kathy, "You said that Zero shot himself. Who told you that? Certainly not Zero." Answer, "Nobody had to tell me. I saw it happen." Question, "Oh, you were present?" Answer, "Yes." Question, "Can you explain how it happened?" Answer, "I was talking to him, and he walked into the next room. Little Patty was lying on the bed. He sat down on the bed next to her. He reached over, grabbed the gun, and shot himself." Question, "Just like that?" Answer, "Yes." Question, "Out of a clear blue sky?" Answer, "Right out of a clear blue sky." 3 big questions remain. Why was Zero playing Russian roulette with a fully loaded gun? Why, if he took the gun out of the leather case, was the case clean of prints? And why, though Bruce Davis admitted picking up the gun, were neither his prints nor those of Zero on it? About a week after the story of Manson's involvement in the Tate-LaBianca murders broke in the press, Los Angeles Times reporter Jerry Cohen was contacted by a man who claimed he had been present when Zero was shot. Only Zero hadn't been playing Russian roulette. He had been murdered. The man was about 25, 5'8", blonde, of slight build. He refused to give Cohen his name. He was, he admitted, scared to death. 6 or 8 persons had been in the Venice pad that night smoking hash. "It was one of the chicks that killed Zero," he told Cohen. But he wouldn't say which one, only that recently, at another Manson family gathering, she had sat staring at him for 3 hours, all the while fingering her knife. In questioning him, Cohen established that he had become involved with the family after the Tate-LaBianca murders. He had never met Manson, he said, but he had heard from other family members that there had been many more murders than the police know of, and that the family is a whole lot larger than you think. The youth wanted money to get to Marin County in Northern California. Cohen gave him $25, implying there would be more if he returned to identify Zero's murderer. He never saw him again. On November 16, 1969, the body of a young girl was found dumped over an embankment at Mulholland and Beaumont Drive near Laurel Canyon, in almost the same spot where Marina Hubba's body was found. A brunette in her late teens, 5'9", 115 pounds, she had been stabbed 157 times in the chest and throat. Ruby Pearl remembered seeing the girl with the family at Spawn and thought her name was Sherry. Though the Manson girls traded aliases often, LASO was able to identify only one Sherry, Sherry Ann Cooper, a.k.a. Simi Valley Sherry. She had fled Barker Ranch at the same time as Barbara Hoyt and was, fortunately, still alive. The victim, who had been dead less than a day, became Jane Doe 59 in police files. Her identity is still unknown. The proximity in time of her death to that of Zero suggests the possibility that she may have been present at the murder, then killed so she wouldn't talk. But this is strictly conjecture, and there is no evidence to support it. Her murder remains unsolved. On November 21, 1969, the bodies of James Sharp, 15, and Doreen Gall, 19, were found in an alley in downtown Los Angeles. The two teenagers had been killed elsewhere with a long-bladed knife or bayonet, then dumped there. Each had been stabbed over 50 times. Rampart's Division Lieutenant Earl Deemer investigated the Sharp-Gall murders, as did Los Angeles Times reporter Cohen. Although the two men felt there was a good possibility that a family member was involved in the slayings, the murders remain unsolved. Both James Sharp and Doreen Gall were Scientologists, the latter a Scientology clear who had been residing in a Church of Scientology house. According to unconfirmed reports, Doreen Gall was a former girlfriend of Manson family member Bruce Davis, himself an ex-Scientologist. Davis's whereabouts at the times of the murders of Sharp, Gall, and Jane Doe 59 are not known. He disappeared shortly after being questioned in connection with the death of Zero. On December 1, 1969, Joel Dean Pugh, husband of family member Sandy Good, was found with his throat slit in a London hotel room. As noted, local police ruled the death a suicide. On learning of Pugh's demise, Inyo County DA Frank Foles made official inquiries, specifically asking Interpol to check visas to determine if one Bruce Davis was in England at the time. Scotland Yard replied as follows. It has been established that Davis is recorded as embarking at London Airport for the United States of America on 25th April 1969 while holding United States Passport 612-2568. At this time, he gave his address as Dormer Cottage, Felbridge, Surrey. This address is owned by the Scientology movement and houses followers of this organization. The local police are unable to give any information concerning Davis, but they understand that he has visited our country more recently than April 1969. However, this is not borne out by our official records. Davis did not reappear until February 1970, when he was picked up at Spawn Ranch, questioned briefly on the Inyo County grand theft auto charges, then released. After the grand jury indicted him for the Hinman murder, he vanished again, this time not surfacing until December 2, 1970, 4 days after the mysterious disappearance of Ronald Hughes. As mentioned, when he gave himself up, he was accompanied by family member Brenda McCann. With three exceptions, these are all the known murders which have been proven or are suspected to be linked to the Manson family. Are there more? I've discussed this with officers from LAPD and LASO, and we tend to think that there probably are, because these people liked to kill. But there is no hard evidence. As for those three other murders, two of them occurred as late as 1972. On November 8, 1972, a hiker near the Russian River resort community of Guerneville in Northern California saw a hand protruding from the ground. When police exhumed the body, it was found to be that of a young man wearing the dark blue tunic of a Marine dress uniform. He had been shotgunned and decapitated. The victim was subsequently identified as James T. Willett, 26, a former Marine from Los Angeles County. This information appeared on radio and TV newscasts on Friday, November 10th. On Saturday, November 11th, Stockton, California police spotted Willett's station wagon parked in front of a house at 720 West Flora Street. When refused entry to the house, they broke in, arresting two men and two women and confiscating a number of pistols and shotguns. Both women had Manson family X's on their foreheads. They were Priscilla Cooper, 21, and Nancy Pittman, a.k.a. Brenda McCann, 20. A few minutes after police entered the residence, a third female called, asking to be picked up and given a ride to the house. The police obliged and also arrested Lynette Frome, a.k.a. Squeaky, 24, ex officio leader of the family in Manson's absence. The two men were Michael Monfort, 24, and James Craig, 33, both state prison escapees wanted for a number of armed robberies in various parts of California. Both had the letters AB tattooed on their left breasts. According to a spokesman for the State Department of Corrections, the initials stood for the Aryan Brotherhood, described as a cult of white prison inmates, dedicated largely to racism, but also involved in hoodlum activities, including murder contracts. While in the house, the police noticed freshly turned earth in the basement. After obtaining a search warrant, they began digging, and early the following morning exhumed the body of Lauren Willett, 19. She had been shot once in the head, her death occurring either late Friday night or early Saturday morning, not long after the identity of her slain husband was revealed on news broadcasts. Questioned by the police, Priscilla Cooper claimed that Lauren Willett had killed herself playing Russian roulette. Although, like Zero, Mrs. Willett was not able to contradict this story, the Stockton police were far more skeptical than had been LASO. The three women and two men were charged with her murder. They were scheduled to go on trial in May 1973. On April 2nd, however, four of the five surprised the court by entering guilty pleas. Michael Monfort, who pleaded guilty to the murder of Lauren Willett, was sentenced to 7 years to life in state prison. Superior Court Judge James Dara also ordered consecutive terms of up to 5 years and 2 years for James Craig, who had pleaded guilty to being an accessory after the fact to murder and to possessing an illegal weapon, i.e., a sawed-off shotgun. Both girls also pleaded guilty to being an accessory after the fact, and both Priscilla Cooper and Nancy Pittman, a.k.a. Brenda, who Manson once indicated to me was his chief candidate for family assassin, were sent to state prison for up to 5 years. Still another family member, Maria Alonzo, a.k.a. Crystal, 21, arrested while trying to smuggle a switchblade knife into the Stockton jail, was subsequently released. As was Squeaky. There being insufficient evidence to link Lynette Frome to Lauren Willett's murder, the charges against her were dropped and she was freed to again assume leadership of the Manson family. Monfort and an accomplice, William Goucher, 23, subsequently pleaded guilty to second-degree murder in the death of James Willett and were sent to state prison for 5 years to life. Craig, who pleaded guilty to being an accessory after the fact to the murder, was given another prison term of up to 5 years. The motive for the two murders is not known. It is known that the Willetts had been associated with the Manson family for at least a year, and possibly longer. Police surmised that Lauren Willett was killed after learning of the murder of her husband to keep her from going to the police. As for the murder of James Willett, the official police theory is that Willett himself may have been about to inform about the robberies the group had committed. There is another possibility. It may be that both James and Lauren Willett were killed because they knew too much about still another murder. James and Lauren. Something about those first names seemed familiar. Then it connected. On November 27, 1970, a James Forsher and a Lauren Elder drove defense attorney Ronald Hughes to Sespe Hot Springs. After Hughes disappeared, the couple were questioned, but not polygraphed, the police being satisfied that when they left the flooded area, Hughes was still alive. At first, I thought Elder might be Lauren Willett's maiden name, but it wasn't. Nor in checking the police reports and newspaper articles was I able to find any description of Forsher and Elder. All I did find were their ages, both given as 17, and an address from which I subsequently learned they had long since moved. All other efforts to track them down were unsuccessful. It appears unlikely that James Forsher and James Willett were the same person. Willett would have been 24 in 1970, not 17. But Lauren is a decidedly uncommon name. And 19 in 1972. She would have been 17 in 1970. Coincidence? There had been far stranger ones in this case. One thing is now known, however. If an admission by one of Manson's most hardcore followers is correct, Ronald Hughes was murdered by the Manson family. It was some weeks after the conclusion of the Tate LaBianca trial before I received the autopsy report I'd requested from Ventura County. The identification, made through dental x-rays, was positive. The body was that of Ronald Hughes. Yet the rest of the autopsy report added little to the newspaper accounts. It noted, the decedent was observed face down in a pool of water with the head and shoulder wedged under a large rock. One arm was almost completely severed at the shoulder, and there were large open areas in the chest and back. Other than this, no outward evidence of violence was noted, while no evidence of foul play was indicated by the x-rays. All this was qualified more than a little by the fact that the body was badly decomposed. As for the report's primary findings, there were none. Nature of death, undetermined. Cause of death, undetermined. The report did note that the stomach contained some evidence of medication residue, but its exact composition, drugs, poison, whatever, was, like the nature and cause itself, left undetermined. Completely dissatisfied with the report, I requested that our office conduct an investigation into the death of Hughes. The request was denied, it being decided that since there was no evidence of foul play, such an investigation was unnecessary. There the matter remained, until very recently. While the Tate LaBianca trial was still in progress, motion picture director Lawrence Merrick began work on a documentary on the Manson family. The film, simply titled Manson, dealt only briefly with the murders and focused primarily on life at Spawn and Barker Ranches. I narrated a few segments, and there were interviews with a number of Manson's followers. The movie was shown at the Venice Film Festival in 1972 and nominated for an Academy Award the following year. During its filming, Merrick gained the confidence of the Manson girls. Sandra Good admitted, for example, on film, that when she and Mary Brunner learned of the Tate murders while still in the Los Angeles County Jail, Mary said, "Right on," and I said, "Wow, looks like we did it." Off camera and unrecorded, Sandy made a number of other admissions to Merrick. She told him, in the presence of one other witness, that to date the family had killed 35 to 40 people, and that Hughes was the first of the retaliation murders. The trials did not write fini to the Manson saga. As Los Angeles Times reporter Dave Smith observed in West magazine, to pull the curtain over the Manson case is to deny ourselves any possible hint of where the beast may come from next, and so remain afraid of things that go bump in the night, the way we were in August of 1969. Mass murders have occurred throughout history. Since the Tate LaBianca slayings, in California alone, labor contractor Juan Corona has been convicted of killing 25 migrant farm workers. John Lindley Frazier slaughtered Dr. Victor Ota, his wife, two of his sons, and his secretary, then dumped their bodies in the Ota swimming pool. In a rampage that lasted several months, Herbert Mullen killed 13 persons, ranging in age from 3 to 73. Edmund Kemper III, ruled insane after slaying his grandmother and grandfather, was ruled sane and released, to later kill his mother, one of her friends, and six college co-eds. And a possible total of 17 murders has been attributed to two young ex-convict drifters. With the exception of the latter pair, however, these were the work of loners, obviously deranged, if not legally insane, individuals who committed the murders by themselves. The Manson case was, and remains, unique. If, as Sandra Good claimed, the family has to date committed 35 to 40 murders, this may be near the U.S. record. Yet it is not the number of victims which makes the case intriguing and gives it its continuing fascination, but a number of other elements for which there is probably no collective parallel in the annals of American crime. The prominence of the victims, the months of speculation, conjecture, and pure fright before the killers were identified. The incredibly strange motive for the murders, to ignite a black-white Armageddon, the motivating nexus between the lyrics of the most famous rock group ever, the Beatles, and the crimes, and behind it all, pulling the strings, a Mephistophelian guru who had the unique power to persuade others to murder for him, most of them young girls who went out and savagely murdered total strangers at his command, with relish and gusto, and with no evident signs of guilt or remorse. All these things combined to make Manson perhaps the most frightening mass murderer, and these murders perhaps the most bizarre in American history. How Manson gained control remains the most puzzling question of all. During the Tate-LaBianca trials, the issue was not so much how he did this, but proving that he did it. Yet in understanding the whole Manson phenomenon, the how is extremely important. We have some of the answers. During the course of his wanderings, Manson probably encountered thousands of persons. Most chose not to follow him, either because they sensed that he was a very dangerous man, or because they did not respond to his sick philosophy. Those who did join him were not, as noted, the typical girl or boy next door. Charles Manson was not a Pied Piper who suddenly appeared on the basketball court at Texas State, handed Charles Watson a tab of LSD, then led him into a life of crime. Watson had quit college with only a year to go, gone to California, immersed himself in the selling as well as the using of drugs before he ever met Charles Manson. Not just Watson, but nearly every other member of the family had dropped out before meeting Manson. Nearly all had within them a deep-seated hostility toward society and everything it stood for, which pre-existed their meeting Manson. Those who chose to go with him did so, Dr. Joel Hochman testified, for reasons which lie within the individuals themselves. In short, there was a need, and Manson seemed to fulfill it. But it was a double process of selection, for Manson decided who stayed. Obviously, he did not want anyone who he felt would challenge his authority, cause dissension in the group, or question his dogma. They chose, and Manson chose, and the result was the family. Those who gravitated to Spahn Ranch and stayed did so because basically they thought and felt alike. This was his raw material. In shaping that material into a band of cold-blooded assassins who were willing to vent, for him, his enormous hostility toward society, Manson employed a variety of techniques. He sensed and capitalized on their needs. As Greg Jacobson observed, Charlie was a man of a thousand faces who related to all human beings on their level of need. His ability to psych out people was so great that many of his disciples felt he could read their minds. I doubt seriously if there was any magic in this. having had many, many years to study human nature in prison, and being the sophisticated con man that he is, Manson probably realized that there are certain problems that nearly every human being is beset with. I strongly suspect that his magical powers were nothing more and nothing less than the ability to utter basic truisms to the right person at the right time. For example, any girl, if she is a runaway, has probably had problems with her father, while anyone who came to Spawn Ranch was searching for something. Manson made it a point to find out what that something was, and supply at least a semblance of it, whether it was a father surrogate, a Christ figure, a need for acceptance and belonging, or a leader in leaderless times. Drugs were another of his tools. As brought out in the psychiatric testimony during the trials, LSD was not a causal agent, but a catalyst. Manson used it very effectively to make his followers more suggestible, to implant ideas, to extract agreements. As Paul Watkins told me, Charlie always took a smaller dose of LSD than the others, so he would remain in command. He used repetition. By constantly preaching and lecturing to his subjects on an almost daily basis, he gradually and systematically erased many of their inhibitions. As Manson himself once remarked in court, "You can convince anybody of anything if you just push it at them all of the time. They may not believe it 100%, but they will still draw opinions from it, especially if they have no other information to draw their opinions from." Therein lies still another of the keys he used. In addition to repetition, he used isolation. There were no newspapers at Spawn Ranch, no clocks. Cut off from the rest of society, he created in this timeless land a tight little society of his own, with its own value system. It was holistic, complete, and totally at odds with the world outside. He used sex. Realizing that most people have sexual hang-ups, he taught, by both precept and example, that in sex there is no wrong, thereby eradicating both their inhibitions and their guilt. But there was more than sex. There was also love, a great deal of love. To overlook this would be to miss one of the strongest bonds that existed among them. The love grew out of their sharing, their communal problems and pleasures, their relationship with Charlie. They were a real family in almost every sense of that word, a sociological unit complete to brothers, sisters, substitute mothers, linked by the domination of an all-knowing, all-powerful patriarch. Cooking, washing dishes, cleaning, sewing, all the chores they had hated at home, they now did willingly, because they pleased Charlie. He used fear very, very effectively. Whether he picked up this technique in prison or later is not known, but it was one of his most effective tools for controlling others. It may also have been something more. As Stanford University professor Philip Zimbardo, a longtime student of crime and its effects, noted in a Newsweek article, "By raising the level of fear around you, your own fear seems more normal and socially acceptable." Manson's own fear bordered on paranoia. He taught them that life was a game, a magical mystery tour. One day they would be pirates with cutlasses, slashing at anyone who dared board their imaginary ship. The next, they'd change costumes and identities and become Indians stalking cowboys. Or devils and witches casting spells. A game. But there was always a pattern behind it. Them versus us. Dr. Hockman testified, "I think that historically the easiest way to program someone into murdering is to convince them that they are alien, that they are them and we are us, and that they are different from us. Krauts, Japs, gooks, pigs." With the frequent name-changing and role-playing, Manson created his own band of schizophrenics. little Susan Atkins, who sang in the church choir and nursed her mother while she was dying of cancer, couldn't be held responsible for what Sadie Mae Glutz had done. He brought to the surface their latent hatred, their inherent penchant for sadistic violence, focusing it on a common enemy, the establishment. He depersonalized the victims by making them symbols. It is easier to stab a symbol than a person. He taught his followers a completely amoral philosophy, which provided complete justification for their acts. If everything is right, then nothing can be wrong. If nothing is real and all of life is a game, then there need be no regret. If they needed something that couldn't be found in the garbage bins or a communal clothing pile, they stole it. Step by step. Panhandling, petty theft, prostitution, burglaries, armed robberies, and last of all, for no motive of gain, but because it was Charlie's will, and Charlie's will is man's son, the final step, the ultimate act of defiance of the establishment, the most positive proof of their total commitment. Murder. Comedians punned that the family that slays together stays together. But behind the grim jest, there was truth. Knowing they had violated the strictest of all commandments, created a bond not less, but more binding, in that it was their secret. He used religion. Not only did he find support for much of his philosophy in the Bible, he often implied that he was the second coming of Christ. He had his 12 apostles several times over, not one but two Judases, Sadie and Linda, his retreat to the desert, Barker Ranch, and his trial in the Hall of Justice. He also used music, in part because he was a frustrated musician, but also because he must have known it was the one thing that could get through to more young people than any other. He used his own superior intelligence. He was not only older than his followers, he was brighter, more articulate and savvy, far more clever and insidious. With his prison background, his ever-adaptable line of con, plus a pimp's knowledge of how to manipulate others, he had little trouble convincing his naive, impressionable followers that it was not they, but society, which was sick. This, too, was exactly what they wanted to hear. All of these factors contributed to Manson's control over others. But when you add them all up, do they equal murder without remorse? Maybe. But I tend to think that there is something more, some missing link that enabled him to so rape and bastardize the minds of his followers that they would go against the most ingrained of all commandments, "Thou shalt not kill," and willingly, even eagerly, murder at his command. It may be something in his charismatic, enigmatic personality, some intangible quality or power that no one has yet been able to isolate and identify. It may be something he learned from others. Whatever it is, I believe Manson has full knowledge of the formula he used. And it worries me that we do not. For the frightening legacy of the Manson case is that it could happen again. I believe Charles Manson is unique. He is certainly one of the most fascinating criminals in American history, and it appears unlikely that there will ever be another mass murderer quite like him. But it does not take a prophet to see at least some of the potentials of his madness in the world today. Whenever people unquestioningly turn over their minds to authoritarian figures to do with as they please, whether it be in a satanic cult or some of the more fanatic offshoots of the Jesus movement, in the right wing or the far left, or in the mind-bending cults of the new sensitivity, those potentials exist. One hopes that none of these groups will spawn other Charles Mansons, but it would be naive to suggest that chilling possibility does not exist. There are some happy endings to the Manson story, and some not so happy. Both Barbara Hoyt and Diane Lake returned to and graduated from high school with apparently few, if any, permanent scars from their time with Manson. Barbara is now studying to be a nurse. Stephanie Schramm has her own dog grooming shop. Paul Watkins and Brooks Poston formed their own combo and appear at various clubs in the Inyo County area. Their songs were good enough to be used as background music in the Robert Hendrickson documentary film on Manson. After the fire, George Spahn sold his ranch to an investment firm, which planned to turn it into a dude ranch for German visitors to the United States. He's since purchased another ranch near Klamath Falls, Oregon, and Ruby Pearl is running it for him. I haven't heard from Juan Flynn recently, but I'm not worried about him. Juan was always able to take care of himself. Though I last saw him in my office, for some reason I visualize him on a big white horse, his pretty girlfriend behind him holding on for dear life as they gallop off into the sunset, which I suspect is Juan's own image of himself. Since the murder of his wife, Roman Polanski has produced several motion pictures, including a new version of Macbeth. Critics noticed in his interpretation disturbing parallels to the Tate murders. Polanski himself posed for an Esquire interview, holding aloft a shiny knife, and according to the press, he has recently moved back to Los Angeles, into a home not far from 10,050 Cielo Drive. Polanski's attorney, working in conjunction with LAPD, divided the $25,000 reward as follows. Ronnie Howard and Virginia Graham each received $12,000, while Stephen Weiss, the young boy who found the .22 caliber murder weapon, received $1,000. Neither Danny DiCarlo nor Alan Springer was around to share in the reward. Shortly before the Watson trial, Danny skipped bail on the federal gun charge and fled to Canada. His exact whereabouts are unknown. According to LAPD, biker Al Springer simply vanished. It is not known whether he is alive or dead. Ronnie Howard tried working as a cocktail waitress, but found it difficult to hold a job. Everywhere she went, she said, she was identified as the Manson case snitch. Several times she was beaten up on her way home from work, and one night someone fired a bullet through the living room window of her apartment, missing her head by inches. The would-be assailant was never identified. The next day she told reporters, "I should have kept my mouth shut in the first place." Virginia Graham had a job as a receptionist in a legal office and seemed well on the way to rehabilitation when she jumped parole. As this is written, she is still a fugitive. 7 months after reporter Bill Farr declined to tell Judge Older, who gave him the Virginia Graham statement regarding the celebrity murders the Manson family had planned, Judge Older called Farr back into court and ordered him to either do so or be found in contempt. Under California law, the confidentiality of a reporter's news sources is protected. However, since the Tate-LaBianca trial, Farr had left the Los Angeles Herald Examiner and was now working in a press secretary job. Older said that since he was no longer a reporter, he was no longer protected by the law. Farr argued, and I feel quite persuasively, that if Older's order was permitted to stand, both the news media and the public would suffer, since if not guaranteed anonymity, many persons would decide not to provide essential information to the press. On both constitutional grounds and his own personal convictions, Farr declined to identify his sources. He did state, on the advice of his attorneys, that he had obtained copies of the Graham statement from two lawyers and another person subject to the gag order, but he declined to name them. Under orders from Judge Older, defense attorneys Day Shin, Irving Kenrick, and Paul Fitzgerald, and prosecutors Stephen Kay, Donald Music, and I all took the stand. All six denied under oath giving the statement to Farr. At least two of the six were apparently lying. All I know is that I didn't give Farr the statement. As for who did, the listener's guess is probably as good as mine. Judge Older held Farr in civil contempt and sentenced him to an indefinite jail term. He later served 48 days in the Los Angeles County Jail before being freed by an order by U.S. Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas, pending the outcome of a new appeal. had Farr been cited for criminal contempt and given consecutive sentences, the maximum penalty would have been 65 days in jail and a fine of $6,500. But Older cited him for civil contempt and gave him an indefinite sentence, which could mean that if Older remains adamant and the higher courts rule against Farr, he could remain in jail for as long as 15 years, until 55-year-old Charles Older reaches 70, the mandatory age of retirement. Many, though not all, of the hardcore Manson family members are now serving time in various penal institutions. Other family members split to follow new leaders. Kathy Gillies, according to the last information I received, was a mom with one of the motorcycle gangs. Still others continue to make headlines. Maria Alonzo, a.k.a. Crystal, who was released shortly after the Stockton murder, was arrested in March 1974 and charged with allegedly plotting to kidnap a foreign consul general in an attempt to secure the release of two prisoners in the Los Angeles County Jail. As this is written, she has yet to be brought to trial. For a time, there was a spate of books, plays, and motion pictures which, if not glorifying Manson, depicted him in a not wholly unfavorable light. And for a time, it looked as if a Manson cult was emerging. Not only were there buttons reading Free the Manson Four, that cancerous growth known as the family again began growing. When interviewed, the new converts, who had never had any personal contact with Manson, looked and talked exactly like Squeaky, Sandy, and the others, giving rise to the very disturbing possibility that Manson's madness might be communicable. But the strange phase quickly passed, and there is little left of the Manson family now, though little Squeaky, chief cheerleader of the Manson cause, is still keeping the faith. Although undisputed leader of the family while Charlie is in absentia and presumably involved in the planning of their activities, and though arrested more than a dozen times on charges ranging from robbery to murder, she has only been convicted a few times, and always on minor charges. Moreover, not long ago, she found a champion in, of all places, the district attorney's office in Los Angeles. One of the young deputy DAs, William Melcher, first became acquainted with Squeaky while the group was holding its vigil on the corner of Temple and Broadway. For Christmas 1970, Melcher's wife baked cookies for the Manson girls, and a friendship developed. Not long after Squeaky was released on the Stockton murder charge, she was rearrested as a suspect in a Granada Hills armed robbery. Convinced they had the wrong person, Melcher successfully proved this to the police and she was freed. Clearing her was, Melcher told the Los Angeles Times, my greatest satisfaction in 3 years as a prosecutor. Noting that the group had a lot of ill feeling about the police and courts, I wanted them to know that justice also works on their side of the street. Someday he would like to write a book on the girls, Melcher added. I'd like to write not an exposé of the tragedy and violence, which I do not condone, but a book about the beauty I've seen in that group, their opposition to war, their truthfulness, and their generosity. The fate of Charles Manson, Charles Watson, Susan Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkel, Leslie Van Houten, and Robert Beausoleil was decided on February 18, 1972. That day, the California State Supreme Court announced that it had voted 6-1 to abolish the death penalty in the state of California. The opinion was based on Article 1, Section 6 of the state constitution, which forbids cruel or unusual punishment. In June 1972, the United States Supreme Court ruled, in a 5-4 decision, that the death penalty, if imposed in an arbitrary fashion with the jury being given absolute discretion and no guidelines, constituted cruel and unusual punishment in violation of the Eighth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Although a number of states, including California, have since passed laws restoring the death penalty and making it mandatory for certain crimes, including mass murders, at the time this is written, the United States Supreme Court has yet to rule on their constitutionality. Even if the California law is let stand, it would not affect the Manson family killers, since the new statute is not retroactive. The sentences of the 107 persons awaiting execution in California were automatically reduced to life imprisonment. Manson, in Los Angeles as a defense witness in the Bruce Davis trial, grinned broadly on hearing the news. In California, a person sentenced to life imprisonment is eligible to apply for parole in 7 years. By August 1972, the last prisoners had left California's death rows, most to be transferred to the yards or general inmate population of various state penal institutions. Although at this writing, Atkins, Krenwinkel, and Van Houten remain in the special security unit constructed for them at the California Institute for Women at Frontera, it is likely that in time they will join the general population also. In his psychiatric report on Patricia Krenwinkel, Dr. Joel Hochman said that of the three girls, Katie had the most tenuous hold on reality. It was his opinion that if she were ever separated from the others and the Manson mystique, it was quite possible she would lose even that and lapse into complete psychosis. With regard to Leslie Van Houten, who of the three girls was least committed to Manson, yet still murdered for him, I fear that she may grow harder and tougher. I have very little hope for her eventual rehabilitation. Writing of Susan Atkins, Los Angeles Times reporter Dave Smith expressed something which I had long felt. Watching her behavior, bold and actressy in court, cute and mincing when making eye play with someone, a little haunted when no one pays attention, I get the feeling that one day she might start screaming and simply never stop. As for the other convicted Manson family killers, Charles Watson, Robert Beausoleil, Steve Grogan, a.k.a. Clem, and Bruce Davis, all are now in the general inmate population. Tex is no longer playing insane and has a girlfriend who visits him regularly. Bobby received a certain amount of national attention when he was interviewed by Truman Capote during a TV documentary on American prisons. Not long afterward, his jaw was broken and his hand dislocated in a brawl in the yard of San Quentin. The fight was the result of a power struggle over the leadership of the Aryan Brotherhood, with which Beausoleil had become affiliated. The AB, which is believed responsible for more than a dozen fatal stabbings in various California prisons in the last few years, is the successor to several earlier groups, including a neo-Nazi organization. Its total membership is not known, but it is believed to have about 200 hardcore inmate followers, and it espouses many of the same racial principles that Charles Manson did. The legacy lives on. Of all the Manson family killers, only their leader merits special handling. In October 1972, Charles Manson was transferred to the Maximum Security Adjustment Center at Folsom Prison in Northern California. Described as a prison within a prison, it provides special housing for problem inmates who cannot be safely controlled in the general prison population. With the transfer, Manson lost not only all of the special privileges afforded those awaiting execution, he also lost his regular inmate privileges because of his hostile and belligerent attitude. "Prison is my home, the only home I ever had," Manson often said. In 1967, he begged the authorities not to release him. Had anyone heeded his warning, this book need never have been written, and perhaps 35 to 40 people now dead might still be alive. "In convicting him," Manson said, "I was only sending him home. Only this time, it won't be the same," observed San Quentin warden Lewis Nelson. Before Manson was transferred to Folsom, "It would be dangerous to put a guy like Manson into the main population because in the eyes of other inmates, he didn't commit first-class crimes. He was convicted of killing a pregnant woman, and that sort of thing doesn't allow him to rank very high in the prison social structure. It's like being a child molester. Guys like that are going to do hard time wherever they are." too, like Sirhan Sirhan, convicted slayer of Senator Robert Kennedy, his notoriety is his own worst enemy. For as long as he remains in prison, Manson will be looking over his shoulder, aware that any con hoping to make a reputation need only put a shiv in his back. That Manson, Watson, Beausoleil, Davis, Grogan, Atkins, Van Houten, and Krenwinkel will be eligible for parole in 1978 does not mean that they will get it, only that this is the earliest date they will be eligible to apply. The average incarceration in California for first-degree murder is 10.5 to 11 years. Because of the hideous nature of their crimes and the total absence of mitigating circumstances, my guess is that all will serve longer periods. The girls, 15 to 20 years. The men, with the exception of Manson himself, a like number. As for the leader of the family, my guess is that he will remain in prison for at least 25 years, and quite possibly the rest of his life. In mid-October of 1973, some 30 prisoners in California's toughest lockup, Folsom Prison's 4A Adjustment Center, staged what was described by the San Francisco Chronicle as a peaceful protest against prison conditions. The man who used and championed fear did not participate. According to the Chronicle story, mass murderer Charles Manson is among the inmates in 4A, although prison spokesmen say he is not involved in this demonstration. Manson has been threatened by other inmates in the past, and authorities say he seldom ventures out of his cell for fear of being attacked. Afterward. 25 years after, as I said in my summation to the jury, Charles Manson sent out from the fires of hell at Spawn Ranch 3 heartless, bloodthirsty robots to commit the savage and nightmarish Tate LaBianca murders, the nation continues to be fascinated with the Manson murder case. And the question I am always asked, particularly by the news media, is why? Why has this mass murder case, as opposed to every other, and there have been many, continued to intrigue and captivate millions of people the world over, to the point where 5-year anniversaries of the murders, as with no other murder case in America except the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, are marked by articles, news reports, and television specials, not just in the United States, but internationally? This year, the British Broadcasting Company and ARD, German National Television, are airing 25th anniversary specials on the case. To the point where, as reported in the Los Angeles Times, Manson receives more mail than any other inmate in the history of the U.S. prison system, an alarming amount of it from young people who tell him they want to join his family. Where Manson T-shirts are selling well today around the country, where there have been several plays about him, even an opera, The Manson Family, that premiered at New York City's Lincoln Center in July of 1990, as well as a CD soundtrack of the opera released in 1992, where the multi-platinum rock band Guns N' Roses sing a Manson composition, Look at Your Game, Girl, in their latest album, where, believe it or not, avant-garde typographers in California produced a new typeface called Manson, in which for $95 art directors, per Time magazine, can set their serial killer zeitgeist essays in Manson Regular, Manson Alternate, or Manson Bold, all renamed Mason after criticism. Where free Manson graffiti soils the landscape of Britain's largest cities, and according to the BBC's William Scanlon Murphy, Manson interest in Britain is approaching mini-mania proportions. Where the television adaptation of this book about the case was, when it aired in 1976, the most watched television movie in the history of the medium, and like no other film of a murder case ever, has continued to be shown year after year without fail in the United States and many other countries of the world. Where a March 1994 ABC television special on the case produced the highest ever ratings for a network magazine show debut. Again, why is this so? In a March 4, 1994 letter to me, Murphy writes, "There are 32 British rock bands that I know about playing both Manson's own songs and songs in support of him, and a further 40 or so in Europe, particularly Germany. Only last week, one of the worst I've heard, Charlie's 69 Was a Good Year, came out, recorded by a band called Indigo Prime. I'm sorry to say that it appears to be selling well. For some reason, the Neo-Manson cult seems to center in Manchester, where there are 5 stores selling free Charles Manson t-shirts, which are fantastically popular on rave dance floors, and bootlegged records of his music. However, it's far from exclusive to Manchester. There was an all-Manson concert in London in January, attended by 2,000 people. There is a full-fledged Manson Appreciation Society, Helter Skelter, UK, based in Warrington, Cheshire. Posters supporting Manson are a common sight in the major cities, especially in the run-up to concerts by the Mansonite bands. The majority of the supporters of these bands are under 25. The truly frightening part is the fact that many of them, when asked, turn out to be Manson buffs, who have read all they can find about Manson and strongly approve of Helter Skelter. There are very strong links to ultra-far-right political parties, particularly the British National Party." After the Tate LaBianca murders, there was a killer in Los Angeles called the Trash Bag Killer, so named because he picked up drifters and hitchhikers, murdered and dismembered them, then put them in trash bags. He pled guilty to 21 murders. Yet, I don't remember this murderer's name. And I would wager that if you were to ask 100 people in Los Angeles, you'd be hard-pressed to find one person who did. This is not that uncommon. At the time of a mass murder, and when the suspected killer is apprehended and tried, there's always considerable publicity. As a general rule, however, within a short time thereafter, the murders and the identity of the perpetrator tend to fade from the public's consciousness. But not so with the Manson case. In fact, next to Jack the Ripper, whose identity still hasn't been conclusively established, Manson is probably the most famous and notorious mass murderer ever. So what is it? A view that's enjoyed some currency is that the murders represent a watershed moment in the evolving social structure of our society. This view holds that the Manson case was the end of innocence, the 60s mantra of love, peace, and sharing in our country, and sounded the death knell for hippies and all they symbolically represented. In Joan Didion's memoir of the era, The White Album, she writes, "Many people I know in Los Angeles believe that the 60s ended abruptly on August 9, 1969, and in a sense this is true. Even now, in 1994, ABC's Diane Sawyer endorses this notion when she says the Manson murders brought an end to the decade of love, and something changed in the heart of America with the murders." Others feel, less extravagantly, that the murders were emblematic of the counterculture flower gone to seed. As Time magazine said in 1989 on the 20th anniversary of the murders, the 3 female killers were any family's daughters, caught up in the wave of drugs, sex, and revolutionary blather that had swept up a generation of young people. Or, some thought for a time after the murders, perhaps Manson and his disciples represented a 10 or 20-year extrapolation of the direction in which the counterculture movement was going, and so forth. All of these hypotheses seem to be devoid of supporting empirical evidence. For instance, although the Manson murders may have hastened its descent, the age of Aquarius, of which Woodstock, 1 week after the Manson carnage, was at once its finest hour and last gasp, was already in decline. As the decade of dissent and raw excess approached its denouement, the movement's mecca, Haight-Ashbury, was in ruins, and America had begun its retreat from the war in Vietnam, the political raison d'etre fueling the movement. Moreover, Manson and the madness he wrought did not reflect the soul of the late 60s, when admittedly the anti-establishment movement had reached a feverish crescendo. That movement indeed wanted a new social order, but largely one brought about by peaceful means. Manson advocated violence, murder, to change the status quo. As pointed out in the body of this book, though Manson was a hero to some, according to surveys at the time, a majority of young people whom the media labeled hippies disavowed Manson, stating that what he espoused, i.e., violence, was antithetical to their beliefs. Although I view Manson as an aberration who could have occurred at any time, the late 60s obviously provided a much more fertile soil for someone like Manson to emerge. It was a period when the sex and drug revolution, campus unrest and civil rights demonstrations, race riots,